Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning, and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about who can you trust, and who better to put our trust into what he's got to say is Mark Levine, attorney at law, Handler and Levine, fellow seminar presenter. And how long have you been an attorney?
How long have you been? 21 years.
21 years.
A little over 21 years.
Mark looks very young for for 21 years of that stress factory. Anyway, so we're going to talk about who can you trust. I suppose I should ask the question, what is a trust?
Well, what I was thinking we would talk about this morning is all those different people that you have to put your faith in. If you're no longer around to do things, you're putting your faith in a lot of different people or roles. And one of those is a trustee. One of those is an agent under a power of attorney, the executor of your will. And so that's one of the big questions and a lot of the things that we spend a lot of time on in the seminars is talking about who are the appropriate people to do these roles. And a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about who that person should be in different situations, when, how, or if professionals ever play a role in that, what sorts of checks and balances and transparency and things like that. So I think that the thing that most people worry about is when they're talking about their kids and what happens if they're gone and they create a trust for their children. So in this case, what we're talking about when we talk about a trust is something that comes into existence after you die. You create a document, usually in your will or in your revocable living trust, that says, at my death, at my spouse's death, create this entity. We're going to put money in it. The trustee, the person that you ultimately name, is going to be in control of it. And we're going to have guidelines for how they use the money for our kids. And it's an incredibly powerful position, not just in terms of what they do with the money and mistakes they may make or things they may do well, but also the influence that they then have on your kids. They are the people that ultimately your kids have to come to the way they would have come to you. And so I think one of the big issues that people start out with is I'm going to have a guardian for my children if they're minors, and I'm going to have a trustee for my kids. And a lot of people assume that they should be different people, that you need the checks and balances of those sorts of things. And what I think a lot of clients figure out as we talk about it is it's really hard to say to someone, look, I trust you with my kids. I trust you to take care of them every day and deal with them and be this not just legal guardian for them, but the person that they turn to for guidance. But I don't trust you with their money. So I'm going to give the money to somebody else. And a lot of clients, when they sort of think through that, immediately feel uncomfortable with that and feel like, no, I think I've got to trust them, but I'm worried. And I think those worries, there are some well-placed reasons for that. There are gray areas. When someone is both the guardian and the trustee for your kids, how they use the money affects them as well as your kids. So do they use your kids' money to buy groceries? Do they buy your kids' money to put an addition on the house? Do they use your kids' money to buy a minivan because they only had a sedan before? And you know what? If you're going from them having two kids to them having five kids, all of those things make perfect sense, that they should be using some of the money you've left behind for your kids to pay for this. But those are some gray areas. And I have clients who, when we talk this through, feel uncomfortable that perhaps their guardian, while wonderful with kids and trustworthy with their upbringing, may not be great in gray areas, especially if they don't have money themselves.
Okay, could I ask you some tangent questions?
Sure.
What if there are no kids? Do you set up trusts for other family members that you might not think would do the right thing with the funds or that just need guidance?
I think those become tougher questions. As you have adult children, as you have other adults in your life that you want to take care of, I think a lot of times when we're talking about whether or not we create a trust, we're looking at two different scenarios. So one scenario is I've got a child, a relative, a friend with a drug problem, an alcohol problem, a spousal problem, a spending problem, and I feel like it's my responsibility, if I'm going to leave them money, to have some sort of structure for how they use it. And then I think there are people on the other side who feel like this person has a decision-making problem, but not necessarily one that if they use all the money very quickly and it's gone will necessarily affect them negatively the rest of their lives. And so when we have those people with a drug or alcohol problem, it's almost mandatory to leave the money in trust. You know, if you leave that kind of money to somebody, they could use that kind of money to kill themselves, to hurt somebody else by engaging in the things that they abuse. And so that's the first part of the question when we're talking about other people that we're leaving money to. Can they handle it? Is there a problem? Are they a danger to themselves or others? And then you get to, I think, the second part of that analysis, which is, okay, they're not a danger to themselves or others, but do you want to control how they use the money, access the money, what they use it for, where it is when they're gone, where it goes ultimately? And so I think those are the questions you look at when you're creating a trust. And I think the role of trustee is a little bit different there, because one of the things when we're talking about the guardian and trustee, and what I say to clients is, you don't want your guardian to lose all their power at 18. Your kid turns 18, the legal guardian becomes irrelevant. It's the person with the money that matters. And so what we often talk about in situations where you're concerned about the guardian's control of money is, let's make them at least a co-trustee. Let's have them part of that process so that at 22, the person that raised them from 8 to 20 to 18 is involved in the decision about whether or not money should be distributed to them. And so I think that whether you're talking about minor children, adult children, or third parties, you really want to think about where that role is, who that person, what role are they fulfilling. And so when we're talking about a 16-year-old child, I'm less concerned about the guardian. The guardian isn't the person who is raising them. The guardian is the person who's keeping them safe for the, you know, last 2 years of their minority, as opposed to someone who takes over when they're six. And so there's a lot of different things that we look into with that. You want to decide with your trustee, and part of that is who your trustee is, what kind of flexibility you're giving them, what kind of flexibility you're giving somebody else. You're giving the child, you're giving the beneficiary. And that also goes into who the beneficiary or who the trustee is in those situations.
Okay. For the longest time prior to entering the profession I'm in, trust to me were for somebody else. It was somebody with a lot of money. But I think that's not necessarily the case. And correct me if I'm wrong here. Sometime there might not be a need for a trust because they don't have any money until they die. And if they die early, then there's this life insurance. Does life insurance ever go into a trust? Well, for estate tax purposes, probably, but it might be for handling purposes as well. I like what you said. And then I'm going to – this two-pronged question. Then the other is, what preconceived notions do you find with people that walk into your office that really don't know, or the extreme, this is who I want? And then how do you gently say, maybe that's not the one, not that you know the person, but you know the concept? Fire away.
So
sorry.
No, that's good. The first part of that is a lot of people, most people with minor children, understand the concept that almost any amount of money they have is too much to give the six-year-old or the eight-year-old, or that there needs to be some sort of structure in that money. One of the tough things for people to move past is the idea that when they think about what's my estate, they're thinking about how much money do I have if I want to go buy a car? What's my money if I want to go on vacation? And that clearly is not what we're talking about. We're talking about what's there when you die. And that includes life insurance and equity in your house and your TSP or IRA or 401k. It includes all of those things together. And that's what's ultimately going to your kids. And our concern is that 18-year-olds make spectacularly bad decisions with money. 21-year-olds make slightly less spectacular bad decisions with money. And we want to make sure that we're controlling when they get that money. There's an old saying, we want to give them enough to do something, not enough to do nothing. And so we want that person in control of the money so that our kids have to get up every day and go to work. They have to get up every day and do the things we want them to do. The money is there so that they can have a nicer car and a nicer house and a nicer vacation, but they still have to get up and go to work every day. They have a safety net, but not something that's going to provide for them instead of doing it themselves. And that's the concept of the trust. And most people with younger kids really understand that, I think. They understand that's why they went out and got the life insurance to begin with, is for the kids. I think that as people get older, when they're talking about trusts for probate avoidance or incapacity planning, those are when people question the need of a trust for themselves. Why do I need a trust for me versus why do I need it for my minor kids? It's not usually a very hard thing to explain why you need it for that minor child. So I think what's harder is that second part where people come in and they've got adult children. They're very comfortable with where their adult children are in their lives. And they go, well, why would I use a trust for myself? Why would I use a trust for my spouse? And if I do these things, who is it that's going to be in charge of them under what circumstances? So the second part of your question was, I think it's going to be this person. And very often the misconception is they come in and say, well, I have two kids or I have three kids and I'm going to make all of my kids trustees, or I'm going to make all of my kids co-agents under my power of attorney or co-executors under my will. And that's where we get into a discussion of who these kids are, because more often than not, that doesn't work. Not necessarily because you've got bad kids, not necessarily because they aren't smart enough or able to do it, more often because the baggage that they bring with them into this role is real. And in all of these situations, you're no longer there to act as a mediator. You're no longer there to explain one of them to the other. You're no longer there as the check on their bad behavior. So if your kids don't get along now, it's unlikely that they're going to step forward and be better versions of themselves when you really need them to be. They're more likely to be the people that they are in those situations. And so you really need to think about, are they all appropriate, number one? Because often if you have three kids, you often only have one that you actually trust to get your mortgage paid on time. And so you want the person who you trust to be efficient and get things done to be in charge. And number two, how do they get along? Often I'll have something where the client will say, I have these two kids. My daughters get along great. They love each other. I said, well, are their work styles different? Absolutely. One of them gets everything done early. The other one gets everything done at the very last possible minute. I said, well, how do you think the one who waits to the last minute is going to affect the one who gets everything done early? Oh, she'll drive her crazy. That's the one thing she hates about her sister, et cetera, et cetera. And so we start exploring not just how do we get power to people, because that's easy, relatively easy. It's the what happens next that's hard. How are my kids going to get along? How can I protect their relationship as time goes on when they've got to fill in these roles and I'm no longer able to do that? So we definitely explore who the people are, how they get along, how they interact with each other as part of choosing who that trustee or agent's going to be.
All righty. And again, when we talk about this, I hope the listeners aren't zoning off that say, I don't have that kind of money. But can the TSP go into a trust?
It can, but it should not.
Okay.
The TSP, you've not yet paid money, taxes on that money. And going into what would be a sort of typical accumulation trust would be a bad idea. There are trusts that it can go into. But generally speaking, we want the TSP to go to a person if that's appropriate. So anytime your TSP is going into a trust, you're really looking to see, is there a control reason? Is there a need for it to go into trust where we're not going to have the income tax benefits that we want? And it's only where we look at those control reasons that we seriously start looking at putting it into a trust. Now, that said, the agent under your power of attorney, who you can think of sort of as a trustee in this situation, they are your fiduciary. They're the person making legal and financial decisions for you if you can't do it for yourself. That person will hopefully have control over your TSP. There's a specific TSP power of attorney form, and so you can't count on your regular power of attorney, either a statutory version or a LegalZoom version or even the version done by your attorney to deal with your thrift. You want to make sure you're using the specific form that they have for a power of attorney to make changes and make decisions about your thrift. But that person is the person who's going to make decisions about investments, withdrawal, rolling it over, things like that, if you can't for yourself.
In your experience, have you ever talked with a person or met a potential trustee who's just really a good person, thinks logically, but doesn't have a clue about money?
Sure. And I think that's another big misconception people have. People will say to me, well, I'd like to pick this person, but they're not really good at investing money. And I think if I had to boil down the two most important characteristics of a trustee, an agent under a power of attorney, a personal representative under a will, I would say the two most important qualifications are trust and common sense. If you don't trust the person, don't pick them. I've had this conversation where people say, well, if I pick my brother-in-law, couldn't he steal all the money from me? And my immediate response is, look, if you're not picking your brother-in-law, he's not the right guy. The second part of it's common sense. Common sense is more important than financial ability or acumen. I'd rather have someone who knows they don't know how to invest money than someone who thinks they do know how, even in fact, if they do know how. I want someone who understands that they have limitations, that they should hire an accountant and a financial advisor, and when they have legal questions, they should seek out an attorney and manage those people. And that's common sense. That's what that takes. So the person that you describe, a good person, intelligent, thinks things out, but just doesn't really have the interest or ability to manage money. If they have common sense, if they will surround themselves with people and take good advice, they may still be a great person for that job.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a real life question. Years ago, I agreed to be trustees on probably too many trusts. Don't do it anymore unless I really, really know the person. And I had this one situation where the beneficiary didn't like whatever I did, they didn't like. I was to buy tech stocks before they fell apart. And I go, no, this has to last for a long period of time. Sued me. I want to have the mortgage paid off in the house because of better interest rates. And I go, no, we're making more. Sued me. And finally, at the fourth suit, I said, you know, you can sue me till forever, but you know who's paying the legal fees? And the person said, who? I said, you. It's coming out of your trust. And I said, every time we've done this, we haven't had success. Let's just be friends, you know, and actually turn the person around. In their heart of hearts, they kind of knew, but they wanted to be the big man on campus, I guess, because I was between them and the money. But it had to last this person until they were 40. And at 40, they got it.
I think a trustee always has to be able to look at the long view. Understand that their role isn't just what happens today or tomorrow. It's for the existence of the trust, and they have to be able to say no. One of the things we talk about when we're talking about who the right person is their ability to say no. And so we had a situation with a client who has three kids, and one of them has issues, drug problems, alcohol problems. It's the oldest son. And for a long time, she really wanted her middle son to be the trustee for the older son. And we talked about the fact that at some point he's going to have to choose between being a brother and being a trustee. At some point when the older son says to him, I want this money, and he says no, he's no longer available to the older son as a friend, as a trust, as a brother. And a couple years ago, the client called me and said, you know, my middle son said to me, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be in this role because... And then basically said word for word to mom what I had said to her. And she said it made me realize that I really need someone who doesn't have to make that choice. And so you have to make sure your kids, if you're choosing them as trustees or your friends or your aunt or your uncle or your cousin, has the ability to say no and maintain that relationship. And so one of the things we did in that situation, she ultimately decided she wanted to make me a co-trustee so that I could be the bad guy. So that the middle son could say to the older son, look, I would give you the money, but that Levine, he won't do it. And ultimately, she moved away from that and moved away to just wanting me to be the trustee. And at this point, I had represented the family for over 10 years, and I was comfortable doing that. But there can be bad situations. So we've had situations where we would get, and this will tell you how long ago this was, 6 or 7 faxes a week. Saying you're doing this and you're doing that and you need to give us this money and you need to do this. And the same situation where we would reply calmly, this is what the decision is. And every time you make me respond, I have to spend time, which ultimately comes out of the trust.
Okay. If a trust is set up, are there different type of trusts that would last for a certain, I think I know the answer, last for a certain period of time and then the assets are distributed? Or if there's a trust and somebody's still alive, can they go, I don't want to do this anymore? This is the person that set up the trust, if you will, not the attorney, but the person putting the money into the trust.
The grantor.
Yeah, the grantor. Grantor, is that the word? Okay, grantor.
It's a word.
Thank
there are
you.
Other words.
All righty, the grantor. Yeah, but the grantor is still alive, but they go, I don't want to do that anymore, and they shut the trust down. Is that called a revocable trust?
Right. In order to be able to undo it, it would be a revocable trust, a revocable trust that you're generally with a revocable living trust. You're the grantor, the person who creates it. You're the trustee, the person who's in charge of it, and you're the beneficiary. And as long as you're competent, you remain all three. And if you become incompetent generally, or you decide you don't want to be in charge anymore, you would lose the role of trustee, and that would go to your successor trustee, someone else who's making those decisions for you. People can undo those trusts. They can completely abandon them. They can move money in and out of them. They're intended to be simply another version of them that's there for control purposes or probate avoidance purposes. A trustee can always resign. So if someone else is serving as trustee, they have the ability to say, I don't want to do this anymore. Now, they have things they have to do. They have to do accountings. They have to, you know, give notice to the new trustee, things like that. Also, people don't have to take the role on. A lot of people say, do I need to talk to my brother about the fact I'm going to make him the trustee or the agent under my power of attorney? And the answer is no, you don't have to tell them, but you also have to understand that when something happens, they don't have to pick up the mantle. They don't have to do it. Now, if they start doing it, they have to do it right. They have a fiduciary duty. They have to act in good faith. But if they don't want to do it at all, they can simply choose not to do it.
Hmm. How far down the line do you go? You have a trustee, and then if they're no longer around for whatever reason or decide not to do it, it goes to position two. Do you go to position three, four, five, six? I mean, these go ad infinitum. But how far do you usually drill down to which layer?
I have clients who have trouble coming up with number one and number two. I have clients who have no trouble rattling off seven or eight. Generally, people are going to have two, maybe three. They're going to have a primary backup and maybe one or two other backups. The important thing about the trust is that the trust itself be what I would call self-sufficient in that regard. There's a provision in the trust that we do that say, if you become trustee and there is not a successor then able to serve if something happens to you, your first job is to name a successor. So my sister is the trustee for my kids if something happens to my wife and I. And if something happens to us and she becomes trustee and she looks and sees that the office of successor trustee to her is not open, that there's nobody there, that person perhaps is gone or unwilling or something, her first job is to name a successor to herself. So it's self-perpetuating. She always has the ability to name someone to take over for herself. And you want to make sure that a document that you do has that kind of provision because you can't tell the future. I think I've said this before on the show, but I spend my life dealing with morbid improbabilities. What if this terrible thing happens? What if that terrible thing happens? What if all the terrible things happen? What happens next? And making sure that the plan and the documents deal with what happens next.
Okay, I know there's some listeners at this point saying, how do I get in touch with Mark? How do we get in touch with Mark?
Well, you can email me. My email address is Mark, M-A-R-C, at handlerlevine.com, handlerlevine.com, and it's Mark with a C. You can call. My phone number is 301-961-6464, and my extension is 3313. So email Mark at handlerlevine.com or call 301-961-6464.
Now, you know, we have listeners well outside the Beltway. Should they feel comfortable in calling? Because
I'm always happy to talk to people and try and give my two cents. But ultimately, if you live in Oregon, you're going to want to find an attorney in Oregon because there's always differences. There's always things that are different in the different states. And as attorneys, it's not good practice for us to start doing plans for people in other parts of the state where we don't practice.
Yeah. Now, you do have an office in Virginia?
We do. We meet with clients in Tysons as well as in Alexandria, but our primary office is in Bethesda.
Okay. All right. And for those of you all not familiar with the D.C. metro area, you can drive to all three jurisdictions probably in a half hour if you hit it at the right time,
and
about 3 a.m.
And you're willing to cross the river. That's
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, we have this bridge called the American Legion Bridge, and when we talk about cross the river, it's not on a ferry. It's on a patience-draining journey. All righty. We got trust, revocable, irrevocable wills. I mean, does the will drive any of this, or does this operate outside the will?
The will is a set of instructions for what happens in probate and for what happens after you die. And so a lot of times within the will, you're going to be first naming an executor, a personal representative, a person who is going to be in charge of gathering your assets, paying your debts, making sure things are done correctly, and transferring assets on to whoever gets them next. So let's say in your will, you create a trust for your spouse or you create a trust for your child. The executor's job is to get the money from you, whatever you had at your death, to that trust and that trustee. Now, often they're the exact same person. In other words, if my wife and I are both gone, my sister, God bless her, is the executor under our will, is the trustee for our kids. And so she's just wearing two different hats. Her job is to get all the money together and then transfer it to herself wearing a different hat. But you may have different people. You may have someone who is local or better with bureaucracy or administrative tasks, and they're your executor or personal representative. And their job at the end of the day is to get the money to the trustee. And so when we talk about naming a trustee for your kids, generally you're going to be doing that either in your will or in your revocable trust. And it's the terms of that will or the terms of that trust that govern what the trustee is doing or not doing, what they can do, what they can't do, how much flexibility are we giving them, or how little flexibility are we giving them.
Okay, you just mentioned the term probate. It's interesting, on the show about 2 weeks ago, actually the person sitting where you are goes, "What's probate, Bob?" Anyway, what is probate and what isn't probate? Probatable assets, is that the proper term?
Probate assets. There are either four or five different ways that assets transfer when you die. One of them is by gift before you die. One is by joint ownership of property with rights of survivorship. One of them is by beneficiary designation, like the beneficiary designations for Fegley or TSP or something like that. And then one is by revocable living trust. And one is by probate. And probate is basically in charge of those assets that are titled in your name when you die without a beneficiary designation and without joint ownership. So for example, mom and dad own a house, joint with rights of survivorship. Dad dies, and the house goes to mom. Now, it was titled in his name. He owned it. But because there was joint ownership, it's not a probate asset when he dies. When mom dies, the house is just in her name. Nobody else owns it jointly with her. There's no beneficiary designation deed. It's just hers. At the second death, it's a probate asset. So you have the same asset. In one situation, it's not a probate asset. In the other situation, it is. But I like to explain it to people, at the second death, your couch is always going to be a probate asset. No one has a beneficiary designation on a couch. No one owns their couch jointly with their kids. At the second death, it's always going to be a probate asset. And that's sort of the way to look at it. A will does not create a probate. A will does not avoid a probate. A will is just a set of instructions for what happens in probate.
So the probate, I guess then, is somebody's overseeing the orderly distribution of the probatable assets, like the courts?
The court is going to be the overseer. The personal representative is going to be the person doing the work.
Okay. Is the TSP a probatable asset?
Almost always no. It could be an asset going through probate if you were convinced somehow to make the estate the beneficiary. So I think the estate comes into the order of precedence somewhere around number five or six or something like that. But for most people, you're going to name a person as the beneficiary of your TSP, and it's going to pass directly to that person. It does not go through probate. If you named your estate as the beneficiary of your TSP, it's going to go through probate. It's going to go into the probatable estate. So the default is no, although you can override that by making the estate the beneficiary. My strong advice is you almost never want to do that.
Yeah.
But people do, and sometimes the TSP is going to be a probate asset.
Okay.
And the same thing is true for Fegley. The same thing is true for your unpaid compensation and accrued leave. If you have an IRA or a 401k, if you have a 403b, all of those things are generally going to be controlled by beneficiary designations, and they're generally going to avoid the probate process entirely.
That would be good.
I think it's just always more efficient. Whether probate in some states suffers from a bad reputation, and whether in some states it deserves its bad reputation, in all cases, it's more efficient if we can avoid it. So even in cases where we've got a will that creates a trust for my kids, for example, I am not going to make my estate the beneficiary of my life insurance. I'm going to make the trust that's created in probate the beneficiary of my life insurance. So it goes directly to that trust once it's created, rather than going through the estate, through probate, then to the trust for my kids. So even in those situations, we're still trying to be more efficient and avoid the probate process, because it just usually makes sense to do that with most assets.
Not long ago, there was somebody in class and actually asked a question in front of the class, which was a little surprising. And they go, I don't have a will. And, you know, we talk to mid-career and pre-retirees, and I don't have a will. I think there's a natural reluctance to many people to want to address the fact that we're going to die and what happens to it. But you should see an attorney, and one is following. Or if you don't like that person, I don't think you were on that day. there certainly are others. And then, well, what about LegalZoom? And we're not going to throw rocks at anybody or anything. But what do you do with kind of the rookie that's well past 35 or 40? And I think I need a will. And maybe they're married, maybe they're not.
I think with anything, it's education. First of all, people don't want to think about it. Some people do. I should take that back. There are some people who are gung-ho and they want to plan, and they really – it makes them feel more secure about what happens, or if something happens to them, to have planned and have a plan in place. There are more people who would prefer not to focus on the idea that they're mortal and that they're going to die, and they feel like the process of doing estate planning, of creating a will and power of attorney and healthcare directive and beneficiary designations – is all sort of an admission that, yes, in fact, I'm mortal, and yes, in fact, I'm going to die. So for those people, I mean, once they get in the door, it's fairly easy, because they've sort of made that decision. They've made that phone call. They've come in, and they're starting to deal with the process. I think for other people, it's a question of just pointing out to them, look, something's going to happen. You are going to die. Hopefully that's not news to them. And when you go, things will happen. And there are things set in place whether you have a will or not. So as I said, a will doesn't create probate. If you don't have a will, you still have probate assets. But instead of you deciding where things go, the state decides where they go. So if you're happy with the idea that in this area, Richmond or Annapolis or D.C. is going to decide who should inherit from you and who should be in charge, then maybe you don't need a will. But the vast majority of people I talk to question whether the state is really the best person to decide how their kids inherit, or when they inherit, or what's split between their spouse and their kids, or their spouse and their parents, and they want to interpose their own set of directions. And that's what a trust or a will is. You are deciding, here's what happens, and you're pushing aside the state's plan and putting in your own.
One of my best friends is married and couldn't bring themselves to the table to do a will with the spouse. No acrimony whatsoever, because they just fell apart each time. I mean, it took 5-8 years to talk about that eventuality. And just that was interesting. I mean, that was an extreme, but I think a lot of other people don't like it and would like somebody to walk them through it, like you. And here's your options. We're all semi-adults or adults, and this is what we want to do, not just to have it, but for the orderly distribution after we're gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why the class is such a great resource for people, because they really get a chance to get a taste of what it is that they should have been doing or didn't do or have to update without having to pick up the phone that first time. That sort of admission that I am going to die and I need to plan for this, they get to come to the class and listen to all of this and feel much more comfortable about making that phone call to whoever they make it to, whether it's me or anyone else. They've sort of thought about some of these issues now and realized, yeah, I really need to do this. There's no age or amount of money at which a will is not appropriate. There's no age or amount of money at which you shouldn't be planning to make things as easy as possible for the people who are going to pick up and take care of things. And there absolutely is no age or amount of money at which you shouldn't be doing a power of attorney and a healthcare directive. Those are for every single person from the day you turn 18 to the day you die. So some part of estate planning is for you, because if you don't do it, other people will step in and do things, and you may not like what they do.
Okay.
One of the big things that prevents people from coming in, especially with little kids, is who are the guardians going to be? Who are the trustees going to be? And what I say to them is, look, if you do nothing, someone's going to step up. And if you don't think you'd like who that person would be, you need to step up ahead of time and say who you want. And I think that strikes a chord with people, that, yes, they don't want to make a choice, but we can't let perfect get in the way of better. And we need to pick the person who would be better than the person who would show up to do the job if we don't say who we want.
Okay, there's probably somebody listening, and it's 10:41 a.m. February 3rd. We're on for about another 24 minutes, Andrew. And then after, if you're listening to it after that time, you can email us. But right now, you can call us, 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And take advantage of Mark's presence here and the ability to make the ununderstandable understandable. Wait a minute. Yeah.
Yeah, that
makes
sense.
Too many uns? Okay.
No, I think that worked out.
All righty. Now, let me ask you, this is not in the script or anything else. Give me the top few questions you get from class where it's not somebody just asking you a question to ask a question, but you say, that's pretty good. That's not a fair question.
Good questions.
Yeah, good questions.
Not just the common questions.
No, well, let's do the common questions too, because...
Well, so the common questions are sort of using software programs or... Well, you know, one of the most common questions is, especially for people in this area, is what happens when I leave this area? I do a will and a power of attorney and a healthcare directive and a revocable trust, perhaps, while I'm living in Virginia. And I'm going to retire and I'm going to move to Arizona or California or Florida or Texas. And what happens to my documents? What should I do? Do I have to do all of this all over again the moment I walk into that other state? And the question, the answer, as it is with so many legal things, is maybe sometimes. Your documents are valid anywhere if they're valid where you execute them. So your healthcare directive, for example, is absolutely a valid expression of what you want to happen, whether you are living in Maryland, Virginia, Texas, California, doesn't matter. Powers of attorney have more statutory issues that you have to think about in terms of land, in terms of statutory provisions and things like that. So it's always a good idea when you get to that new place to talk to someone. But the moment you walk into that state, you have documents and you have some protection. It just may not be as efficient as what it was in the state where you did it.
As is usual with your presence, we have a caller. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes.
All righty, you're on the air.
I just got a question about the trust. And once I say, I'll hang up and listen to the gentleman. It's about the trust about minors and guardians. How many guardians are you allowed to have by law? What happens if the guardian passes away while the kids are still minors? And can it be either, it's a two people, whether it's a trustee or a guardian, and how is possession split? Let's say your wife gets the house, your kid gets whatever, and is a will or trust only for married people and not single people? And that's my question.
Okay. Well, I think I'll answer the last part of that first. There's nothing about a trust or a will that's only for a married or single person. I think the issue that you were focused on about kids, it's clearly for anyone who has minor children, anyone at all, single or married. If you have minor children, you need to have a will. You need to have either a will and a trust or just a will alone that deals with, number one, who the guardians are, and number two, who the trustees are. In terms of how many people you can have, generally speaking, we don't like to have more than one or two people as the guardians, and it's two people if they're sort of living together. So the guardians for my kids, if my wife and I are gone, are my sister and my brother-in-law. The trusteeship, generally people prefer to leave with one person, the blood relative in that situation. So you're having two guardians because if my 8-year-old is growing up with my sister and my brother-in-law, who's to say which one of them needs to take them to the hospital or sign a permission slip or deal with the day-to-day world of being their parent? And so we will often have both people be the guardians. The trusteeship, there's never an emergency like that. And so I could have just my sister, for example, as the primary trustee of the trust. What happens to the guardians if something happens to them? We have backups. So if it's not my sister and my brother-in-law, it's someone else. And so you do have backups to the guardianship. And just like we talked about with the trusteeship, if my sister and my brother-in-law are serving and the backup person isn't able to do it anymore, there's a provision that says I'm giving them the power to decide who the next guardian should be in that situation. And I expect them, as one of the first things they do, to deal with that and figure out who would take over for them if they can't do it. So you can have a number of different people as guardians in that scenario. I think it's very hard to have more than one guardian in a household, or more than one household, I mean. So to have your two sisters as guardians, and they live one in California and one in Maryland, doesn't answer the question of where your kids are living and who's making the day-to-day decisions for them. So I think in that instance, we're sort of looking at one household rather than how many people. And then in terms of trustees, it can be as many as you think can work together to make decisions. Generally, that's not more than two or three, and you want to make sure you have provisions for dealing with what happens when they have problems.
Okay, thanks. And we have another caller, but I have just a quick question. Let's get to it after the caller's question. When looking at the trustee and the guardian, do you ever try to pierce into, do these people get along? We'll answer that after the caller. I don't want to let the caller. I was going to forget it if I didn't do this. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering, if there are no children involved and you're a single person, how do you determine whether you need a trust or not? And does the monetary amount of your estate have an impact?
So the choice of whether to do your estate planning primarily through a will or a revocable trust has a lot of different permutations. I think when you're single and you don't have kids, one of the most important is how much do you care about what the process looks like for the people who follow you? So I've had clients who have said to me, look, if I do a trust now, it's going to take my time and my money, or more of my time and more of my money than if I do a will. And if I die and the people who are taking up for me and doing things for me, well, at that point, it's their time and their money. And I'd rather spend their time and their money, you know, have them spend that than me spend my time and my money. So I think you've got to look at what your goals are. I can tell you that things that you look at are what kind of real property you have and where is it located? Is it located in more than one jurisdiction? Do you have difficult to value assets because those become more of a problem in probate? It's not always so much how much you have as the kinds of assets you have. Are they probate assets? Is what you have a lot, but it's all life insurance or all your TSP? So I think there are a lot of different factors that go into whether a trust makes sense for you and also your age. As you get older, a trust is going to be more appropriate regardless of whether you're single or married.
Okay, thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay.
So Bob's question, your question was, do the trustee and guardian get along? And the answer is absolutely. That is mandatory. You simply can't have a trustee and a guardian who would rather kill each other than look at each other, who don't get along, who aren't going to be able to work together. Because what we don't want in this situation where we do separate the trustee and the guardian is we never want the guardian to have to call and say, I'd like to buy a coat for the kid. I'd like to pay for these books for them. We want the trustee and the guardian to get together and create a budget and create an account that the guardian can access for the coat and for a book and for a whatever without having to involve the trustee in all of those decisions. And if they're not going to be able to do that, then that's not a good choice. You've got to replace one of them because they have to be able to work together.
Good. And I could see friction there almost all the time, but you don't want huge friction.
Yeah, I think friction is something that happens, and again, we deal with a lot because it's easy to get power to people. it's hard to deal with what happens next. And one of the big things we talk about when we're talking about agents and trustees and executors is transparency. So you and your siblings, you have three siblings, and your parent is doing a power of attorney that names you as the agent. How does that affect your relationship with your siblings? And one of the big things we've seen is having transparency is huge. Everyone gets copies of the bank statements. Everyone gets copies of the brokerage statements. So your three siblings aren't each calling you every week wondering what are you doing with the money and how much there is and where is it going and all of those things. They get that information without the friction of asking for it. And so that's something you really want to talk to your estate planner about is, okay, I'm naming this person, this child or the sibling is going to be the agent. How do they interact with the rest of the family? And are we going to have problems and friction and things like that?
Okay. Maybe this should be required listening before going to class. Certainly it's archived for people that have gone to class.
It's a big part of what we talk about in class. A big part of what we talk about in class is who are the people? And we spend a fair amount of time right at the very beginning talking about who should the people be and when do they get power and how do they get power and how do they interact with each other and with you.
All right, let's go back to the best of the classes. We talked, I even forgot what we talked about. It was the best of comments or the most repeated type question. What do you feel that when somebody walks in, they're green, if you will? They might have an idea what they're going to hear, but what do you feel that they walk out with where they figure they knew a little bit, but after class they knew a lot more than?
I think they're most surprised by the fact that little of their assets or much less of their assets than they thought passed by their will. They're surprised by the fact that a joint ownership of property overrides your will, that the beneficiary designation overrides your will. And so very often the question I get after we talk about joint ownership and after we talk about beneficiary designations is, well, what's the point of the will? If everything goes these other ways, what am I doing a will for? And that's when we sort of say, look, a lot of people will say to me, what do you do? And I'll say, well, I'm an estate planner. They say, well, I don't need an estate plan. I don't have an estate. I just want a will. And that's where we explain to them, it's about everything pointing in the same direction, using your joint ownership and your beneficiary designations and your will or your trust to point things in the right direction so that you don't have some things going one place and something else going another place and something else going a third place, and making sure that you've got a plan, and that plan encompasses all of the different ways that assets pass at death. And I'd say that's one of the biggest surprises for people, is that if they say in their will, I want my Fegley benefit to go to this person, it doesn't mean anything. All that matters is what's on that Fegley designation.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Is this a proper statement? Everybody has an estate at the day they die, but everybody doesn't have a taxable estate at the day they die.
Sure, that's a huge point. A lot of people assume that estate taxes or inheritance taxes are going to affect them. And the truth is, it's a small minority of people who are going to be subject to estate and inheritance taxes. The federal estate tax exemption is $5.34 million. What that means is that if you put everything you have together and you don't get to $5.34 million, you don't have to file a federal estate tax return. You don't have to pay a federal estate tax. Now, some states are less, Maryland and D.C. specifically, but New York and Massachusetts and a number of states have their own state-level estate tax. And those go from a low of $675,000 to a high of whatever the federal exemption is. So there are some states that tie it to federal estate tax exemption. So you may have an estate tax in a state like New York where you don't have $5 million, where you only have $1.5 million of everything. But if you have less than $1 million, well, except New Jersey is $675,000. Rhode Island is somewhere between $800,000 and $900,000. They index it for inflation. Everywhere else is over $1 million. So you may or may not have an exemption issue at all. You may not be over it. And most states are looking at increasing it. So I know both Maryland and D.C. are actively looking right now at updating their estate tax exemptions and increasing them. Now, that may not come to pass at all, or it may, but they're looking at it. And I would expect there's going to continue to be pressure on states to get it up closer to what the federal exemption is rather than keep it in the lower pieces.
With the TSP being the age that it is, those that started participating when it was first introduced, maybe somebody comes from private industry, puts the money in the TSP, or just somebody that's been with the feds for 10 or 15 years looking downstream, the TSP is a major gorilla in the room of retirement for many. Now, is that subject to a state tax?
Sure. It's subject to a state tax. It's part of your estate for estate tax purposes. And I would say that one of the things that's going to happen certly for federal employees going forward as the exemptions go up is that they're going to be much more concerned about the income tax issues associated with the TSP and other qualified plans than they are with the estate tax. Many, many clients have no estate tax issue whatsoever, but they do have an income tax issue with where am I leaving my TSP? And I'd say that's something that becomes more and more of an issue. So the other big misconception people have is about gifts. People think that the receipt of a gift is taxable. So if someone gives you $20,000, you have to report it as income on your tax return, which you don't. They think that if you give someone more than a certain amount of money, you have to pay a gift tax, which is true, but that amount of money is, again, $5,340,000. So if you're giving your son $20,000, you're not going to pay a gift tax. You're going to file a gift tax return. You've got to tell IRS, but you're not going to pay a tax. So there's a lot of misconceptions going on about gifting or about wills and estate taxes as well.
So if they don't have somebody to give it to, radio show participants would be great, and their engineer as well, right, Andrew? All righty. So we have less than a minute. I think we bring it down smoothly. Final comments?
I think that thinking about who's in charge, thinking about who you want making decisions is not just what job they do, but how they're going to interact with the people you're leaving behind.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. And Mark, one more time, contact point?
Mark@HandlerLevine.com, MARC@HandlerLevine.com.
Okay, thanks. And if you want to email us, for foryourbenefit@nitpinc.com. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.